Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. November 22nd was the 52nd anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today, we rebroadcast an interview we did 2 years ago with JFK researcher and author Mark Lane. Recorded as the nation marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination. Please stay tuned. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slavery for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of just your brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters.
Crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide wars, far for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential fame, at the table then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Peter and I have prepared a series of interviews about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. In this hour, we speak with attorney, author, and JFK researcher Mark Lane, who has been questioning the official account of the assassination from the very beginning and has championed for the release of more government documents about the assassination and its aftermath. Mark Lane is also an author of 3 books on JFK, and here is our interview with Mark Lane.
Mark Lane's been a member of the bar for over half a century. He's the author of 9 books, including New York Times best-selling Rush to Judgment and Plausible Denial. He was involved in a lawsuit against E. Howard Hunt and the CIA at a trial in the Miami District Court. He's a member of the New York State Legislature and is well known for his 50 years of research on the JFK assassination. Mark, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
We're doing just fine. We want you to tell your story, 50 years now, how you got involved originally writing Rush to Judgment. And you were talking about the Warren Commission problems early on. You were literally the first person really to get notoriety around this, and you took a lot of heat. So tell us what happened.
Well, yeah, that was the first one. If you look at the New York Times, just a couple of days after the Warren Report came out, you'll see I am the only person they could find who said there are problems about this, or there might be problems about this. So that was on the front page of the New York Times as the only person they could find. We had about 200 million people living in America then, and they couldn't find anybody else who thought there was a problem. I couldn't understand why everyone didn't think that this was a matter that had to be looked at very carefully. This was not a back alley killing of some unknown person. This was the President of the United States with the greatest protection one could imagine, Secret Service all over the place providing protection, and he was shot down in the middle of America on a bright sunny day with people watching it taking place. And it just seemed to me that there were a lot of questions and that they should be answered. And J. Lee Rankin, who became counsel to the general counsel to the Warren Commission, after we had made all of these complaints to the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, appointed a commission to look into what had taken place, and it was heard by the then Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren. It was politically chosen, 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, 1 member of the Senate, 1 member of the House, etc. It was just a political operation, and they said it was well-balanced. It wasn't well-balanced, but that's a side point. It should not have been a political commission. It should have been a commission made up of historians, investigators, people who knew what they were doing. They had the Chief Justice as the chairman. He attended almost no hearings. I'm the only person in America who testified twice before the Warren Commission, leading to a little confusion to them with the index maker, because The second time I testified, it was said Mark Lane resumed. And if you read the Warren report, I'm referred to as Mark R. Lane because the person who prepared the index thought that resumed was my middle name. In any event, that was a minor problem for the commission. The major problem was that they never investigated the facts, and they never intended to, because J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel, had said from the very beginning, our job is to reassure the American people. Well, that should not have been their job. Their job should have been to get the facts and tell us the facts. And if the facts showed, as they would have, if they looked into them and reported them properly, that shots came from at least two different directions at virtually the same time within 5.6 seconds, and therefore, unless these two guys happened to be unacquainted, there was a conspiracy to kill the president. And that was just the beginning of it. And I was astonished that nobody else saw this. I mean, a bullet hit the president in the back. It exited from the throat. A bullet hit him in the head from the front, drove him backward. Brain and skull material came back to the far left, hit the left, and almost knocked a motorcycle officer who was on that motorbike to the left and rear, almost knocked him off of his bike. And the president was driven back, as you can see in the Zapruder film, the Much More film, the next film, all the films were taken there. Zapruder's not the only one. There are a lot of people there with cameras that day. And if you look at all, they all show the same thing. The president was hit from the right front. Then the first police officer on the scene went up that embankment toward that wooden fence on the grassy knoll, fell off, dropped his motorbike and ran back and found a man coming from behind the wooden fence, and he arrested him. He thought he had arrested the assassin, one of them, and he had. But the man flashed his credentials, which was Secret Service credentials, and therefore he was allowed to leave, never even asked his name. Incidentally, we have now discovered, of course, through frequent motions that I made in the United States District Court actions to declassify classified material. And the reason we won those actions is because I said to the United States District Court judge for the District of Columbia who was hearing the case that the government says that one man did it alone, it was Lee Harvey Oswald. Now they say there are reasons of national security why we cannot see all the evidence which they've classified and hidden from the American people. So I said, Your Honor, which one is this? Did one man do it alone, or is there a national security issue, meaning that more than one person was involved? At that point, he ordered that the documents be released, and two truckloads came to my townhouse in Washington, D.C., with tens and tens and tens of thousands of pages. And that's how we began to look into the evidence which the government did not want us to see.
And one of the pieces of information that has come out was those Secret Service documents that were produced after the assassination by men, by at least three men, one from the Grassy Knoll and two in back of the book depository. These were not Secret Service agents, yet they had full Secret Service documents. The Secret Service has said that they weren't there. And we also know now at this point that the CIA did graphics for the documents for the Secret Service.
Yes, this is interesting. It's an interesting point. We discovered that more recently, and you're quite right, that the CIA prepared the credentials for the news media that day, and everybody in the area in the news media, and those watching nearby who were part of the operation, they all had documents which said they were Secret Service, but they were prepared by the CIA. Now, the first question I have is, why couldn't the Secret Service, remember, the Secret Service is a branch of the United States Treasury. Do they have a printing press? They print all of the money in America. It's maybe the largest printing organization in America, maybe in the world. That's the Treasury Department, which the Secret Service is a member of. So why do they have to ask the CIA to print their credentials and to distribute them? And it's important because when they printed them, they knew who they were giving them to, and when they distributed them, they knew where each person who has a Secret Service credential was going to be, because they, the CIA, had organized that.
That's just one fact, one suspicious thing. But in your book, My Last Word, which just recently came out, you're really describing kind of a summary of your 50 years of research and work. And these are very important things. Now, you were also involved in a lawsuit where the CIA was suing a magazine in Florida for slander, or Howard Hunt was suing for slander, and you became their defense attorney. So what happened with that trial?
I don't really recall. It was 50 years ago. I don't remember the details, but we prevailed. We always prevailed in all of these cases that we brought. As I said, I brought these actions under the Freedom of Information Act, and the government was very reluctant to make stuff available, but finally we got masses of documents, and that's where we learned things that we had never known before. One of the most important things, I think, is how the government decided to keep this secret, and this is crucial. And this is one of the documents that we got under the Freedom of Information Act. And what piqued my interest was that I lived in Washington, D.C. then, right across the street from the Supreme Court, and a half a block away was the Veterans of Foreign Wars building, which is where Earl Warren and his commission held their hearings. So they were nearby, and I heard them. And when I knew they were coming out, I would go over there with the press and listen to what they had to say. And the first question that was asked Earl Warren after the first hearing by a reporter is, when will we get the facts, Mr. Chief Justice, meaning the facts about who killed President Kennedy? And his answer was, you may never get the facts in your lifetime. If all the information was known, hundreds of thousands of Americans might die. The press never picked that up as anything alarming. It was very alarming to me. But now we know what it was, what he was talking about. The CIA had briefed the Warren Commission, a man named David Atlee Phillips, who ran the CIA from his office in Mexico City. He ran the CIA for the Western Hemisphere, including, of course, the United States. They had told Earl Warren that Oswald was in Mexico City at the end of September and beginning of October 1963. He visited the Soviet embassy, and he visited the Cuban embassy. He was in Mexico City because he wanted to go from Mexico City after he came back to America and killed the president. This is the Warren Commission view. So he went from Mexico City, and his plan was to go back to Mexico City, go to the Cuban embassy, and get safe passage to the Soviet Union. That's why he visited the Cuban embassy and the Russian embassy. This was told to the Warren Commission, and the Warren Commission said, well, okay, we've looked into it. Russians and Cubans were not involved. But if these facts ever come out, if these facts come out, the American people will believe that the Russians and the Cubans were involved, and that will be World War III. That's where the hundreds of thousands of Americans are going to die. The only thing is Oswald was never even in Mexico City. And I can prove that nine different ways. I did in Last Word. But this is the most important part now, is that David Atlee Phillips, who ran the CIA in the Western Hemisphere from Mexico City, and who invented the story that Oswald had been in Mexico City, years later spoke at a conference at the University of Southern California. And I was there, and I heard him speak. And he said, when all the facts come out, you will see that Oswald was never in Mexico City. So the guy that started the story, the one that terrorized the Warren Commission into classifying everything, covering everything up for fear that there'd be World War III, was told by Phillips that Oswald was there, and now he's telling us the whole thing was made up. It was quite remarkable. And when this was reported in the news media, one of the apologists for the commission said, yes, it's true. David Phillips did say that Oswald was never in Mexico City, but that's after Mark Lane's brilliant, harassing cross-examination had him so confused, that's what he said. Well, it was at a conference at the University of Southern California. It was tape-recorded. It was in the news media. We have the transcripts and everything. I was there, but I didn't subject him to any cross-examination. And I was surprised when a student in the audience during the question period said, Mr. Phillips, what can you tell us about Mexico City? And that's when he made the statement, after floundering around about Fumley, well, this and that, and well, anyway, you'll see that Oswald was never there. So it wasn't my brilliant cross-examination. I was a witness to it, but I didn't even ask the question. It was asked by some student in the audience. And that's crucial, because if Oswald was not in Mexico City, and the CIA had already established that he was there, and who was Oswald in September 63? Nobody ever heard about him. But the CIA left a trail in Mexico City of someone who was supposed to be Oswald, but Oswald was not there, left a trail in September of 1963, so that 2 months later, when Oswald was arrested for the murder of the president, they could show the Mexico City connection. But the fact that Oswald was never there, and the fact that the CIA had made up that story 2 months before the assassination, tells us a great deal. It tells us that in September 1963, the CIA knew that 2 months later, the president was going to be assassinated in the United States. And how did they know that? They knew it because that's what they were planning to do, and that's what they did.
And David Phillips even ran into a problem when he testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, in that they asked him for proof on the records that Oswald was in Mexico City, and he said they had been destroyed, and the tapes had been destroyed, because they were taped to both embassies. Yet, however, their memo, after Phillips said that the tapes had been destroyed, a memo that was sent to the CIA to Hoover contradicted that, there was a copy of.
Yeah, it was after November 22nd, and it existed. And more than that, they had the tape recordings. And seven FBI agents, seven, that's everyone who had spoken to Oswald. He was arrested, of course, November 22nd, 63, and he was murdered in the basement of the Dallas Police and Courts building 2 days later by Jack Ruby, who had been associated with American intelligence. But during those 2 days, he was questioned by seven FBI agents, nobody else. This is crucial. From the time Oswald was arrested to the time he was killed, he was not allowed to talk to an attorney. And he said, you can see him on the videotapes of him walking back and forth, being led by the police and the Secret Service and the CIA surrounding him. He said, will some lawyer please come forward and give me some advice? Will some lawyer please come forward? I haven't been allowed to see counsel. Okay, I'm a lawyer. That was an invitation. And I went to the Warren Commission. I went to the authorities in Dallas, and I said, I'd like to represent Mr. Oswald. He said, will a lawyer please come forward? I'm coming forward. But they wouldn't let me talk to him. They wouldn't let anyone talk to Oswald except FBI agents. We don't know what was said there. But they would not allow any ordinary civilian, lawyer or non-lawyer, to talk to Oswald. It was important that he be killed before he told anybody anything. Remember, I've been a defense lawyer for 60 years now. And let me tell you, the most important piece of evidence, if you're a defense lawyer in a criminal case, is the defendant. He's your source. Now, he may lie to you, but even then, you have a chance to check it out. And very often, people say they're innocent when they're, in fact, guilty of something. If, for example, if I had seen Oswald, if any competent lawyer had seen Oswald, Gerald Posner, who wrote the Establishment book, the most recent one, in support of the commission, said, if Mark Lane had represented Lee Harvey Oswald, Oswald would have been acquitted. And he's right. Any lawyer could have done that, because what was absent in the charge against Oswald was any evidence that connected him to the assassination. No eyewitness. Nobody saw anything. Nobody did anything to indicate that Oswald was involved. He never confessed. He kept on insisting he was innocent. The government would not allow him to talk to an attorney, because as I said, the first thing I would do, if you were my client, I would say, where were you? And he would tell me where he was at the time. And if it involved other people or other circumstances, I would go check them all out. Doesn't mean the client is telling you the truth. The client often does not. But you can at least check out what he has to say. And then if he's telling you something untrue and you know that, you go back and say, well, listen, I checked that out. That's not true. This witness said you weren't there. And then you have a chance to go on with your inquiry and your investigation. So the crucial piece of evidence, a lot of evidence was destroyed by the government, but the crucial piece of evidence that was destroyed was Lee Harvey Oswald, because that's where every defense lawyer begins, talks to his client, sees what that view is. And this is crucially important that Oswald was not allowed to talk to anyone in the 48 hours that he lived, other than FBI agents, who, of course, had a reason to not tell us what Oswald was saying. On occasion, he'd be leading through the news media, and he would say, "Will some lawyer please come forward and represent me? I'm innocent. I didn't do this." And he thought he had been arrested for killing police officer Tippit, because that's what they told him. And it's right on the videotape. They said, "Did you kill the president?" He said, "What? The president? They haven't even talked to me about that. They said there's some police officer." So there he was in custody, questioned by the FBI. They weren't even asking about the Kennedy assassination. Didn't make any difference what he was going to say, because no one would ever hear it. He was going to be dead within 48 hours. And he was shot to death in the Dallas Police and Courts building while being protected by the CIA, the FBI, the Secret Service, the Dallas Police, the Deputy Sheriff's Association. They were all there, and one guy walked up to him and killed him. And yet America was supposed to be convinced that he did it. He did it alone. And we can be reassured.
And within 2 hours, they were saying he was affiliated with pro-Castro activism, and were started to blame. And that information came out of the Miami CIA station under Phillips.
Well, of course, Phillips made it all up. And, you know, he has since basically said that. As I said, he spoke at USC, and when he made these confessions, basically, that he had made up this story about Oswald's background. They said the apologist for the commission said, "Well, yeah, because Mark Lane subjected him to gross examination." I didn't even ask him a question. It was a student in the audience who merely said, "Tell us about Mexico City." And that's when he told the story. The closest thing I did was sit on the platform and listen to him. There was no brilliant cross-examination or even fairly competent cross-examination. There's no cross-examination at all. And, of course, cross-examination is something that takes place in a courtroom. The witness is under oath, and the judge compels him to answer questions if the questions a judge considers to be relevant. So the judge compels him. So that can't be cross-examination in a public meeting, because all Phillips would have to say if he wanted to say anything and not answer the question is, "That's what classified, I can't go into it." He had said that a number of occasions about a number of different things. So there was no question of cross-examination. There was no compulsion. And it was not even me who asked the question. But for some reason, after all those years, he decided the burden was too heavy and he was going to tell the truth. And later that day, because there was a panel that had a number of CIA people, a number of other intelligence people, and a number of people who opposed what they were doing, including myself, Donald Freed and others. Donald Freed was a teacher out there, a playwright, who had organized that whole conference at USC. And nobody could compel him to do anything, Phillips, or anybody else. And all you have to say is, "That's not relevant, or I'd rather not discuss that," or "It's classified." After all, I was working in my capacity for the Central Intelligence Agency then. He didn't do those things. He answered the questions. There was no compulsion. And he made it plain Oswald was never in Mexico City. So if Oswald was not in Mexico City in September, why did the CIA leave a trail behind saying that he was there in September, knowing that they wanted to have him as the fall guy in the Kennedy assassination? But the frightening thing, of course, is the assassination had not taken place. So they had pre-knowledge of that assassination, which is frightening because there's only one way they could have that, and we know what it is.
We're talking to Mark Lane, longtime researcher on the JFK assassination, author of Rush to Judgment, author of Plausible Denial, and more recently a book, My Last Word. You've been very involved in this, but during the course of your involvement, you now have evidence where the CIA was actually identifying you and calling on their assets in the media to label you a communist and try to discredit you. How did you come about that information?
Good old Freedom of Information Act. And I brought an action in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. Again, the government said it was a question of national security. And again, I said to the judge, They say one man did it and did it alone. There was no conspiracy. They cannot tell us there are questions of national security involved and stick to that story. So which one is it, Your Honor? And he said, which one? And they didn't have an answer. And so they released. He ordered the evidence to be released. And it, yes, it's a kind of a chilling doctrine. It's a CIA document talking about how to silence me. And was sent not only to all of the stations in the United States and all of their contacts in the United States and their assets in the United States. The assets were people who worked up the New York Times, CBS, their assets that they considered to be assets were in all of the news media in America. But it was sent because I was also lecturing on occasion in London and in Oxford and places like that. So it was sent to all of the station chiefs all over the world. And to all of the embassies of the United States, all over the world, and the embassy took action. For example, and they were told how to do it. For example, if it was announced that I was going to speak in Paris, then they would have someone claiming to be with the American embassy in Paris send out a document saying that the place where I was going to speak had been changed, or the day had been changed, or the time had been changed. In other words, they sent out this information so that people would not come. Nevertheless, there were large numbers of people who found their way there, and we were able to get people all around the world involved in this, and that's how we formed a Citizens Commission inquiry in the United States with a number of really important leading people participating, Linus Pauling and many others. They were formed all over Europe as well, with members of parliament and leaders of government even demanding that the information be made available to everyone. So it was an interesting run. And, of course, one of the documents I used when organizing this was the CIA document saying that I had to be silenced. And I said, don't join in that. And then, of course, we heard from J. Lee Rankin, who was a counsel for the commission, and he kept on saying, we have to reassure the American people. How? By telling us that there was a conspiracy to kill the president. We didn't catch the guys that are still out there running around. Do you feel reassured now? That wouldn't do it. How do you reassure the American people? One man did it. He did it alone. He's dead. And it's all over. That's how they could reassure the American people.
And anyone who says to the contrary is called a conspiracy theorist or a communist at that time.
Sometimes both. The thing is that this is not a theory. Shots came from two directions at the same time. That is within 5.6 seconds, at least two different directions at the same time. It's not a theory. You're just indicating that you believe that these two people were acquainted with each other when they both decided to kill the president. And that is proof of a conspiracy. But, you know, the government would refer to me as a conspiracy theorist. While we are talking now, in every city, in every state, there are grand juries who are being presented with evidence by federal authorities or state authorities claiming that some person somewhere was guilty of a conspiracy. This is the major tool used by federal and state courts to prosecute people for crimes which they committed, too often for crimes which they did not commit. They throw the conspiracy count in there. The federal government and every state government and all the prosecutors, they are the conspiracy theorists. They do this thousands of times a day altogether throughout the country. And I said when shots came from two directions at the same time, there obviously was a conspiracy. I did it one time because the evidence called for it. That doesn't make me a conspiracy theorist.
We're speaking with Mark Lane, author most recently of Last Word, My Indictment of the CIA in the Murder of JFK. Mark Lane, this is Mickey Huff from Project Censored. Thanks again for joining us for the interview.
Well, thank you.
You have a chapter in your book, Last Word, called The CIA and the Media, and you just touched on that. Peter just mentioned the term conspiracy theorist and how the CIA hatched that term to discredit J. Edward Epstein and others, and a long history of Operation Mockingbird and CIA folks working inside newsrooms to spread propaganda of official narratives. There's an incident that comes up closer to the present here that involves The Nation magazine and Max Holland that were really doing hit pieces, essentially, on you. Could you tell the story about what happened with that, about Max Holland and about The Nation magazine?
Yeah, The Nation published an article by Howard. It was not just an attack on me. It was a lawyer's conspiracy or something like that. It was an attack upon any lawyer who raised any questions about the Kennedy assassination. And it was written by Max Holland. He was referred to as a nation writer. But if you check him out on the Internet, which I did, check out Max Holland CIA, and you see who he wrote for. It was right after. I'm not sure it's on anymore. But I did it at the time, and I wrote a piece about it. And the Nation published it. I wrote my long letter to the editor denouncing what they had done. It said, who is Max Holland? Are you interested in knowing how his association with the CIA? Go CIA.gov Max Holland. And you'll see he's worked so closely with them that he's the person they refer to as their authority on these matters. So that's who wrote the piece. So it wasn't surprising. I know what the CIA wants to do. The CIA wanted to not let us know the facts. And it's interesting to know how the CIA was set up. It was set up by President Harry Truman. He set up this group, and he wrote about it, and he said that he had set this up in order to, he said it was not going to be operational, it was not going to be policymaking, it was a group because he was getting intelligence, information from the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and every one of these organizations have their own intelligence group, and he was just getting overwhelmed with all these different kinds of statements. So he set the CIA up as an organization merely to look over the intelligence of all the other organizations, synthesize it, and present it to the president. And that's what Harry Truman said. And it's interesting that 1 month to the day after the assassination, when the question was, was the CIA involved, Truman wrote a piece published in the Washington Post. Could have been the New York Times, but he wanted to be in Washington where every member of Congress would see it, in which he said why he set up the CIA and that it was not supposed to be operational, not supposed to be policymaking, but merely a group which gathered some information from the other intelligence agencies and gave it to him. And he felt betrayed that they had done, they'd become operational. So what was he telling us 1 month after the assassination to the day in the Washington Post? He was telling us that the CIA was involved in some horrific policy-making operation, which was the assassination of President Kennedy. Another person actually thought about this long before I did. When Robert Kennedy, then the Attorney General, was told that his brother had been killed, his first question was it the CIA? That was long before I became involved in any of this. So have you have the former president Harry Truman, who knew these guys because he'd set up the agency, and he knew what they were doing. And then you have the Attorney General of the United States, his brother just been killed, both raising the question of the involvement of the CIA. And that was long, long before I became involved in this investigation. The reason I became involved in it, I should say, is that in 1960, I ran for membership in the New York State Legislature from a district which was Yorkville and East Harlem. York was Irish, Jewish, German, etc., and the other part of the district was Hispanic, mostly Puerto Ricans and African Americans. And I said, I'm running now because this is in the hands of organized crime, and it was, and it's been there for years. I'm going to run. If I'm elected, I will not run for re-election. I'll ask the community to pick someone, and I will support him. I served my 2 years in state legislature. I did a number of things there. And first person in America to call the fallout shelter program a hoax and to lead demonstrations of thousands of people against it. And John Kennedy, based upon that, said he was not going to go along with this national fallout shelter hoax. In any event, that was back in the state legislature. And I got to know John Kennedy during that campaign. I worked very closely with his brother Bobby in that campaign. John, I met a few times, and Bobby was one I worked with. So I had a personal interest in this, the same interest that everybody in America had about our president being assassinated. Because do we live in a democracy where we struggle and fight for every vote and then find that a couple of guys with rifles can cancel the election? If that's allowed and there's no response, adequate response by the government, we have to wonder where we're living and if we can call ourselves a democracy if our votes really count.
you brought up Robert Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, at this point. So I want to ask you, you describe how the fact that Robert Kennedy really didn't say a lot publicly about his brother, and that was used to defend the Warren Commission report for a long time. But in 1968, he did meet with Jim Garrison, and Garrison told you this story where Robert Kennedy said to Garrison, "Keep up the good work. I support you, and when I'm president, I'm going to blow the whole thing open." Now, he was saying this to other people as well at the same time, so...
He said it to me.
He said it to you.
Well, I called him and told him, said, "I want to talk to you about some things," and he said, "All right, Mark." I knew him, as I said, I worked closely in the campaign. This is after the assassination this conversation took place. And I said, "I'd like to talk with you. You're free for lunch?" And we made a date for lunch. He said, I'm not going to talk about that. If you want to talk about that, I'm not going to talk about that." And I know what that was. He was so damaged by the loss of his brother. Nobody who didn't know him, if you didn't know him, you would have no idea. I think he went to Indonesia someplace and took off for some time. It just almost destroyed him. But when he came back, we talked, and basically he said this thing to me and said to other people, and that is that he knew he couldn't do anything unless he had power. He was running to be president, and the first item on the agenda was to destroy the Central Intelligence Agency and set up a new intelligence organization which would be responsive to the president and not act on its own and not be involved in this kind of operation activity. And the second thing was to find out all the details about the death of his brother. But, of course, then he was killed, and he never was able to do either of those things.
Mark Lane, I wanted to get back to the original question that I asked about the CIA and the media, and I was curious, just for as a follow-up question, you wrote the editor at The Nation, Katrina Vandenhoevel, quite extensively about Max Holland and the CIA connections and sort of the smear that was happening across the spectrum. What was the reply? I mean, what did you hear back from these folks regarding your letter?
Nothing, but they published my letter.
They did publish your letter, but they said nothing to you directly.
No, that was it. They published the letter, but the fact is that I just said, you know, this guy's being cited everywhere as a Nation correspondent. Aren't you embarrassed? He's a CIA guy. He's a correspondent from the Central Intelligence Agency, and they have sheep-dipped him by dropping him in through Nation magazine. Are you going to allow them to keep on referring to him as a Nation magazine reporter when he is CIA? And they never answered me directly. They published my letter, and as you said, as we agreed, but they never answered me specifically. But I don't believe he was ever again. I'm not sure of this, but I followed it for a while. It was 50 years ago with someone. I don't check the papers every day about Max Holland. But I don't think he's been referred to as a Nation writer since that time.
Mark, what do you make of the conflicting information about the rifle? Originally, the Dallas police said it was a 7.65 German Mauser.
A German Mauser, yeah.
And then it turns out that Oswald didn't have one of those, so it became an Italian Carcano.
Mammoth Carcano caliber 6.5. Okay.
There were two rifles. Or what happened there?
Yeah, well, I testified before the Warren Commission. They asked me to come. They don't want to hear any information from me. They just want to say that I had talked to them. And so they called me before then and let me say whatever I wanted to say. And they basically didn't have any questions. They just wanted to be able to say, well, we listened to all sides. I'll tell you, all seven of them, seven members, were present when they questioned Jacqueline Kennedy. And I'm not sure they were present when they questioned anybody else. It was often not even a member of the commission, sometimes just lawyers for the commission. But they were all there when I was there. And they listened to me. They didn't ask any questions, really. They wanted to be able to say that, yeah, I had testified before them, and I did. But so they could say that, and they published my testimony, and then they reached their conclusions, which had no reality. As I said, a lot of the conclusions had to do with Oswald in Mexico City. And that Mexico City story was crucial because it was then that they were able to say that Oswald had met with the Russians and the Cubans at their embassies, but we don't believe there was a conspiracy that the Russians and Cubans were involved, but the American people will believe it. And as I said, that's why Warren came out from his first hearing and said, you'll never get the truth in our lifetime. And if the facts ever came out, hundreds of thousands of people could die. He's talking about World War III, because if we heard that Oswald was there, we would all say, yeah, let's declare war. Well, of course, we wouldn't do that, but that was something they said they were concerned about. But, of course, when you come right down to it, Oswald was never in Mexico City. The story was fabricated by David Attlee Phillips, who ran the CIA for the United States from his office in Mexico City. Mexico City is a good place for the CIA director of America to be, because they don't have a lot of reporters who are asking a lot of questions, and they don't have police who are wondering about illegal activity taking place there, because they were foreigners, and they didn't care what they did in the United States. Phillips could not operate out of the United States. He was committing too many crimes, including mail fraud and stuff like that, federal crimes. But it's interesting that Phillips finally, at the very end, undercut the entire fabric of the Warren Commission's foundation by saying that Oswald was never in Mexico City, and he's the one who had been the source for saying that Oswald was there, which comes, I say, to a terrifying question. If Oswald was never in Mexico City, but the CIA set up a trail saying that he was there in September so they could link him to a crime which hadn't taken place yet, how did they know in September that 2 months later the president would be killed in America? And the only answer can be is their involvement.
And Oswald's history, of course, joining the Marines at 17, finishing basic, and then studying Russian at the Monterey Language Institute, so that he really became fluent in Russian. He certainly didn't learn that growing up.
Well, he lived in the Soviet Union.
And then moving to the Soviet Union to defect, and then coming back, fully assisted by the U.S. government, coming back.
And his wife, too, was not a citizen.
Exactly. So it's pretty clear that there was some intelligence work going on with Oswald all along.
Yeah, obviously they had picked Oswald out. I'm sure Oswald was not the only one who they could blame the assassination on. I mean, what if he got hit by a truck in Moscow? What would happen to this story? I'm sure there were several people around various places ready to be utilized and set up if everything happened to Oswald.
Was one of these people Gilbert Lopez, who was involved in the Tampa November 18th plan to assassinate Kennedy?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. I've been reading about that, and there were two other assassination plan, November 2nd in Chicago.
Right.
A four-man hit team, too, were Cuban exiles with a fall guy named Thomas Allen Valet, troubled ex-Marine, and then in Tampa, November 18th. All of that, of course, is laid out in a number of books.
Yeah, well, the CIA doesn't have one plan. If they have to have backups, because if they're on a mission, they want to make sure that they accomplish it, and they finally did on November 22nd, and we lost our beloved president. I mean, I knew John, and as I said, I worked with him very closely with Bobby in the campaign, but, you know, his policies during the 3 years he was in office were not all that different, but the feeling in America was after the Ike age of the silence and frozen ideas, all of a sudden the lights were brilliant night in the White House. There was a whole spirit of America. We had a young president, attractive young wife, beautiful kids. I mean, it was like America had changed overnight. We were a country which now had some hope about what the future might bring, and then that ended on November 22nd, 1963. And here we are 50 years later still talking about it because we never got over it. And the most amazing thing is with all of the media in America, all of it, supporting the story that Oswald did it alone, with the government supporting that, with me and a few other people saying, I'm not so sure, almost two-thirds of the American people said they did not believe the story that Oswald was a lone assassin. It shows that American people have a lot more sense than the leadership gives them credit for.
Mark Lane, your book titled Last Word, let's bring this up to the present here we are 50 years later. What do you still have hope for in terms of the Kennedy narrative here? What do you hope happens and hope to achieve with your book, Last Word? And I'd also like to say your postscript is again, profound and striking at the end of that book.
Thank you. What I've hoped for all of these years and worked for all of these years, and this is not the only thing I've done for the last 50 years, but this has been a theme for a lot of my work, is to have this country become an honorable country again. And our honor can be restored only when the government that we elect tells us the truth about what they did 50 years ago. And when that day comes, if it should come, but when it comes, if it does come, we will then be able to say, hold our heads up in the world and say, we are an honorable country. Until then, I don't think we have that right.
Mark Lane, we really thank you for taking the time to update us on your work and honoring the 50th anniversary of the assassination
of John Kennedy,
and we thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was Mark Lane, who's been a member of the bar for half a century, is author of 9 books, including the New York Times best-selling Rush to Judgment and Plausible Denial. He defeated E. Howard Hunt and the CIA in a trial in the U.S. District Court and was a member of the New York State Legislature. He is the best-known researcher of the JFK assassinations. His last book, Last Word, My Indictment of the CIA in the Murder of JFK.
Mickey, you know, when we look at this, and I've probably been preparing for these interviews for 6 months, read a number of books over the summer, we keep running into these contradictions that just make it really difficult to accept Oswald doing this alone. I mean, Aquila Clements was an eyewitness to the Tippit shooting, never called before the Warren Commission, testified that two men assassinated Tippit, and the story is, of course, that Tippit had picked up Oswald and was driving him, and Oswald escaped what was then an assassination plot to kill them both. That kind of information. Then, of course, Bobby Hargis, who was the officer that Mark Lane was talking about at the left rear of the presidential limousine, who, when he sees Kennedy's head literally explode, he's splattered with blood and body parts that came from the front, a frontal shot. And his testimony was left out of the Warren Commission report. And then we have the Secret Service agents who were unaccountable for where they came from. A variety of things just on that day, let alone the circumstances historically of trying to claim Oswald was in Mexico City when in fact he wasn't now, it's quite clear. And then deathbed confessions from Phillips and from Hunt saying that they were there and involved in that. And all of that, of course, is circumstantial. But it's quite an amazing story when we look at it, let alone the fact that other assassination plots have been occurring both in Tampa, November 18th, and Chicago on November 2nd, that were uncovered by the police there and Secret Service and intercepted. Yet Kennedy was still allowed to go down to Dallas and be in an open car. And then the route of the caravan was changed at the last minute, literally the day before, bringing him by the school depository building. And then, of course, the old movie JFK and the involvement of the people from New Orleans and the Cubans paints a picture that there was a huge planning conspiracy, pre-knowledge, and we don't necessarily know who the individual shooters were, but we certainly know that there was a whole lot going on.
That's right, Peter. And I wanted to conclude here by actually reading briefly the postscript from Mark Lane's book, Last Word, where he says, quote, "There is more than sufficient evidence for the Attorney General of the United States and for United States attorneys serving in various jurisdictions to impanel a grand jury and consider asking for an indictment of the CIA and its leaders. The failure of nerve and the lack of devotion to principle are all that prevents those sworn officers of the court from acting in accordance with the law and their obligations. If all that is now required is an accusation, I accuse." That's how Mark Lane ends his book. And certainly we're still waiting 50 years later for the truth to finally come out about who killed JFK.
And what's encouraging is more and more information continues to come out. A lot of what we've talked about today was acquired in the last 10 years, particularly since the JFK movie, since all the documents have been released, and then further examination and testimony from people is giving us a better view of what really happened. I think one of the most recent books that a number of people have been reading this past year is Peter Janney's book, Mary's Mosaic. Mary Meyer was married to Cord Meyer, who worked in the CIA. He was actually managed the Mockingbird journalist program, longtime member of the CIA. Mary did not like his work. She did not like his career, and they separated. And she became romantically involved with Kennedy. This is well established at this point, and was influential, they felt, in terms of Kennedy's move towards building peace in the world. The Cuban Missile Crisis had literally come to a level that could have destroyed the world. World War III with missiles flying back and forth. And Kennedy was very concerned about that. He had reached out to Khrushchev, was attempting to break the Cold War conflict that was going on between the USSR. And Khrushchev was more than willing, was trying to do that. He had also reached out to Fidel Castro to try to mediate and bring Cuba back into trade relationships. And Kennedy had ordered troop withdrawals from Vietnam. We only had a few thousand men there, and he was immediately going to bring back 1,000. So there was a lot of motivation there on his part to try to build peace in the world. Mary Meyer was very much part of that, and this whole book describes her involvement and her support of him in that regard and his respect for her, for her perspectives. And Kennedy is assassinated, and Johnson immediately upgrades the Vietnam War, leading to ultimately 50,000 American soldiers dying there and 3 million Vietnamese. And Mary is found murdered less than a year later, an unsolved crime that continues to this day, according to Peter Janney, was a CIA murder.
Peter, there's plenty of evidence then that we've seen through much of this research. And it's also, again, I keep coming back to this point because I think it's a Project Censored focus. It's also the case that the official narrative from the Warren Commission report has been so seared into the minds of Americans, despite the fact that over 2/3 of people don't buy it. But it still continues. And the network shows and so forth that are now on the 50th anniversary of JFK, they're really pushing those. And then they offer often more outlandish or groundless or factless theories to try to straw person style, make it look that anybody that questions the official narrative is making lunatic claims and so on. And I can't help again but go back to Edward J. Epstein, the CIA Mockingbird program, smearing him as a conspiracy theorist. We just heard with Mark Lane again, not only were they CIA trying to discredit him, but they were doing it decades later. The same, again, tired narratives trying to discredit him. And even into the so-called liberal media, you know, not the corporate media, but the liberal progressive foundation funded media, the narratives there of attacking anybody that questions it. And I have to say that we've interviewed several people here, but Mark Lane clearly has something to say about this and is clearly an expert on the matter. And again, anybody that's bothered to do any of the research and look into any of the things that you've just been rattling off here, there were plenty of people that were angry at Kennedy. There were plenty of groups and organizations that wanted to continue American empire in ways that perhaps Kennedy questioned. And, you know, the question may not be who shot Kennedy, but who didn't want to. It seemed like he had a lot of enemies. And again, the Warren Commission report kind of came in and played cleanup.
Well, that feeds right into Peter Dale Scott's hypotheses of deep events and his understanding of deep politics. And he's a dynamic scholar. We have to say that first off. And I would put Jefferson Morley in that category as well, a dynamic journalist who want to stick with what we know, not do speculation on theories. And it's offensive when you see articles written. Most recently was a story out saying, oh, there's 350 conspiracy theories about JFK, as if they were all lunatic. And Morley's quite clear with that, saying that, yeah, there's some are that are pretty awful. And he certainly said the mistaken gunfiring by the Secret Service and the limousine behind blowing Kennedy's head off is an absurd story. But yet that's playing on national television, on reels. So the confusion that's deliberate out there, the labeling of people as conspiracy theorists. And there are, of course, we accept Mark Lane for the research and the 50 years that he's done, but we've also taken a hard look at really hard, good, solid scholars who examine this work in a realistic way. And certainly Peter Dale Scott and Jefferson Morley are exactly that. That's an important piece of everything. And I would have to say that Oliver Stone and the movie JFK are pretty correct on what they've got. And it's a very important film that laid out and brought about the Congressional JFK Archives Records Act back in 92, which released a lot more archives. And from those, we've learned more.
And we've seen the pattern, too. Oliver Stone was viciously attacked when the film came out. 20 years later, over 20 years later, the Blu-ray release is now out. And a lot of, again, what Stone had argued in the film has since been shown to be correct by some of the records released in the archives. Of course, Jefferson Morley at JFK Facts still trying to get more of the material available. And again, to underscore that point, we're looking for transparency here. We're looking to actually see the evidence, the documentation, to really be put this behind us in ways, but also to remind us in the present that transparency is really the only way we can be effectively self-governing as a people. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips of Project Censored. We'd like to make a special thanks to Anthony Fest for helping put together all these broadcasts, and thank you for joining us.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We've just heard a rebroadcast of an interview Peter and I did in 2013 with Mark Lane, an attorney and independent researcher into the JFK assassination. This was part of a four-hour series of interviews Peter and I conducted. You can learn more at projectcensored.org. That does it for today's show. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualized, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We